Welcome to the Cosmic Reality Radio Show with Nancy Hopkins and Walt Silva, produced by Colleen Kelly of Haggy Shack Radio, simulcasted over Cosmic Reality Radio. And welcome to the Cosmic Reality Radio Show. It's December 4th, 2018. My name is Nancy Hopkins, and with me is Walt Silva. Hi, Walt. How you doing?
Hi, Nancy. Hello, everybody.
Are you having a good day?
I could really go to bed right now.
Oh, no. Get some coffee in you. Oh, no. You can't go to bed. You've got to do a radio show with me. You've got to get up. You've got to get excited. You've got to...
I'll take
a nap.
Accident.
Oh, my goodness. So, what's the weather like with you? It's freezing, right?
Yeah, it's minus 6 Celsius.
Oh, my. Oh, no. That's too cold.
Said that northern lady.
Okay, so we had another really good Shungite show. It was the second show that you and I did. JP was there, and it was an amazing... the science that you gave in those first two shows is kind of mind-bending. And it was weird because I was telling Mona this. I said, I'm listening to the show, and I can't remember. I mean, it doesn't really even feel familiar to me in my 3D brain, you know? I'm fascinated with the amount of information that we covered in such a short period of time. But I'm also very aware of the fact that it was an interesting... It was an interesting unraveling of the way that we learned about Shungite, because at that point in the game, we both had some experience with it, but the vast majority of what was going on at that time was very, very theoretical. Well, maybe it's doing this, you know, maybe it's doing that, and... JP was doing the same thing. He and I had been playing with, you know, what could this stuff be? Unraveling its secrets, but mostly unraveling it with little clues and then these kind of downloads of information. And I'm listening to us discuss Shungite and the concept of molecularly, how is it reacting into the quantum field and all that good heavy science. But then there was a certain amount of, I said something concerning the size, and then JP said something, and then you said something, and then it went around again, and finally you had an aha moment. Now, it shocked me that it was at the second radio show, so that would have been September 1st, 2014. And you went, oh, I know what I have to do. I have to put the Shungite powder in the resin. And I'm listening to us having this conversation, and honestly, it was like I had to, how can I explain this? It was this feeling that we weren't theoretically discussing what it might be. It was almost like we were discussing what it could be, and then we made it so. More like you made it so. It was this feeling of much more than theoretics. It was almost like manifesting an explanation. This is the way it works. And I can't explain really why I was having this really very physical, very certain feeling that at that moment in time, Shungite became what we said it was. Can you follow that?
Yeah, because the thing is that it's like we were like a dumb tribe. We can't see the ships floating on the water, so we're looking at the reflection of the ship on the water to get it. Oh, that's what it is. The thing was, has always been there, but no one has seen what it is, or no one has even gotten a notion of the potential of what it can do, of what it can be. I mean, so far, people have worked under the old scripts, the old belief systems. Oh, it's a mineral. Oh, it does this. If you use it in cleansing water, you can use it for so long, then you have to discard it and use a new batch. All of that doesn't do it justice, because instead of truly investigating this, what does it actually do? How does it work? You know, how do you use it? You know, my three basic questions, people are just following the old traditional guidelines. Oh, it's a mineral, you have to cleanse it. Did you see I shared with you and Derek the question from that lady that recently, that she was advised, that someone advised her that Shungite collects, so she's writing me to ask me, how do I clear it? How do I clean it? And then I had to say, well, whoever advised you incorrectly. Because the Shungite doesn't collect anything, it transmutes everything. And you saw my reply to her. If it collected anything at all, then our devices would cease to work, because the magnets would be full of whatever, you know, negative energies or vibrations, and the stickers would work for a while and then they would stop. No, that's not the case. The thing, for heaven's sake, the thing has been around for billions of years. Has it stopped working yet?
It only gets stronger.
Yeah.
But
because
see,
it's the most, like, of all the minerals out there, it's the most psychoactive yet.
Yes. Psychoactive being that it talks to you.
Yeah, it responds to your consciousness. And not only does it respond to your consciousness, I mean, this is one of those things, that's the pity of minerals such as quartz. Yes, they are very good at accepting programming, but unfortunately they don't distinguish. That's why they do use raw quartz wands for black magic and occult things. Because yes, you can program a quartz crystal to a house, a curse, or a hex, or something to hurt someone. Yeah, it will accept it. It doesn't know the difference. But that's where Shungite draws the line. If you try to do that with Shungite, it's just deader than a rock. It will not react to that. And we have anecdotes of that lady that went to a Wiccan gathering with a Shungite pendant, and she was asked to take it off or leave. Somebody knows something and they're not saying, right?
Well, my feeling about what I was hearing happening, and it was sort of like a download thing, you know, because I was just listening, was that in essence, it's like a great puzzle. And Shungite, we know it's a great puzzle, but Shungite does something that another puzzle piece wouldn't do. Shungite saying, just tell me what you want me to do, and I'll do it. So we do this series of discussion that had I not said, and Jay and you, and if the group had not said what they said in the sequence of events that they said it, you wouldn't have gone, oh, I can put it in the powder in the Shungite. I mean, in the resin. You wouldn't have gotten to that point. You might have gotten there some other way. But at that moment in time, with an audience, we were on JP's Journeys with JP, so he had 1,000 people more on that listening at that time. And all those people did the same thing, listening to us. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. And it was very much discussing, not so much manifestation, it was discussing the connection to the quantum field. So we're talking about how it's connecting in a kind of using 3D terms of how it's working. We were talking about, you know, the resonating and the energies and the fullerenes and, you know, the science behind it. But in reality, it was the human brain in the form of a tight group saying, I think this is what's happening. And as we said it, as we thought it, it began to manifest that way. And now the reason that I'm sort of, this seems to be a trending thing today. You know how every show is trend. And it wasn't so much Whitley's show. Whitley got into a discussion with a man by the name of Clive Parker, who in 1973 got beamed aboard a ship. He was from Mississippi, I believe. And it was a re-look at that particular episode in ufology, because it was, again, one of the very early...
It's not the Huxley kidnapping, is it?
No. This is different, because it's an old story that most of us probably don't know anymore. It's being revived, kind of. Because I was not aware of this story when he started relating it.
Okay, but, so this is not the guy that went fishing with his friend's son?
No.
Okay.
No, this guy was with a friend of his, and he talks about... This was before people talked about ETs and UFOs and all. None of that was even within their, let's say, peripheral subconscious. Just didn't exist. So they're out. I got into it a couple minutes late, so I'm not sure what they were doing out there, but they were together, and a bright light started happening. And the next, and he said some very interesting things. He said that they grabbed him by his arm, just by his arm, and he seemed to be floating, but they were directing where he was going. And Whitley got all excited because he said, that's exactly what happened to me, because Clive was saying that, you know, I was 160 pounds and I'm hanging from my arm and I don't feel any problem with the arm. You know, it's not stretched out and hurting. It's just stretched out and I'm like floating. And, you know, they go up into this ship. And the other thing that was, he even thought it was kind of comical. He said, I kept looking around to see where the light fixtures were because it was so bright in there. I couldn't imagine where all these lights were coming from. And he says, you think somebody that just got taken up into a spacecraft would be not concerned with where the light fixtures are? He said, but I kept looking around for them. He was funny. But they, when they came back, when they were brought back, and it was a typical thing, you know, they did something up his nostrils and, you know, typical kind of exposure.
Yeah, without his permission.
Well, without his permission. But when they were brought back, let go again, his friend wanted to talk to somebody, tell somebody. And this guy, Parker, he was just like, I didn't want to do that, you know? It's like, nobody's going to believe us, you know? And he said, besides, I was about to get married. I didn't want my fiancé to think I was a crackpot. But the friend had to call, so they called. And you know what? They could make a telephone call for 10 cents. They had to find a booth, but they made the call. And they called the local Air Force base, and they said, no, we don't look into that stuff. Call the local cops. So the local cops, they call them, and the local cops showed up right away. And Parker was so funny. He says, of course they did. They thought that there was two hillbillies out there, drunker than skunks, calling them about UFOs. They wanted to get us off the road. So sure enough, the first thing that happened was he was told to get out of the car, because he was sitting in the car, get out of the car and do the, you know, field test, you know, jump up and down, count, you know, that stuff to see if they're... And he said, well, you're obviously not drunk. Follow us back to the station. So, obviously he wasn't drunk, otherwise they wouldn't have let him drive the car back to the station. So, what he was saying is that after that, it was again, a typical story, you know. There was some press and he said, I actually would have sat down and told the story, but the press were trying to get into our faces, and he said, I just didn't want to be in that environment, because they were so pushy. He said, and then, even though I never said anything to them, they'd make up stories about what I did say. So, Anyway, so they're having a discussion about that. Then Jeremy gets on. And Jeremy's doing a solo hour show. And all I can tell you is that it was like somebody in a paper bag trying to fight their way out. You know, mentally. Well, he's an experiencer in that he has had many, many visitations by what he eventually, as a young person, considered ETs. You know, I mean, Whitney comes out with his book and all this sort of thing. But I'm watching both he and Whitley, and I don't listen to too many others, who are beginning to question. Actually, Whitley's been questioning it for a long time. If it is really ETs, if they even exist, he's wondering if it's not some kind of, Whitley, not some kind of manipulations by people in the secret space program or something else.
Mucking. Well, Wilcock and Curry Good have been talking about it for some time now, that the people of the inner earth have been pretending to communicate with people on the surface, posing as ETs, you know, letting their ships be seen, communicating with them telepathically. But they never say, oh, we're like you. We're natives of the earth. It's exact that we live inside and you live on the surface. They're not doing that at all. So that's one of the things that, according to him, that when there was this huge galactic meeting of, so according to their description of things, there's supposed to be a galactic station, like a way station, in orbit around Jupiter, but it's not visible because, you know, it's they have this, you know, the technology that they can hide, you know, artificial bodies, so it's not something you can see with a telescope. And they were called there, and they had you know, what was the expression when somebody reads you the riot act? Because they've been told that they've been bad stewards of the earth. They haven't been doing their job correctly. And this business of pretending to be ETs, it's a big no-no. They shouldn't need to be doing that, which they have been done consistently. That's why the thing with the big controversy with this guy, Billy Meyer, that these so-called Pleiadians, not Pleiadians, they you see the name written, it's with a J, Pleiadian. They are the spitting image of these white Nazis that went to the South Pole. And because, you know, they spoke fluent German, and there's a big difference between telepathically speaking to you in your own language, because as Linda Moulton Howe said, you know, the extraterrestrial can tune in to your language center in your brain. So in your mind, you hear your own language, your own native language. But in this, in the case of Billy Meyer, they're openly speaking German because, you know, Billy is in Switzerland and he speaks German and they're speaking in German. So a lot of the people that I've seen, like the pictures of the ships, they're like the spitting image of those initial UFOs that the Nazis made at the end of the war. So these people could very easily be living either under the Antarctic ice or on the inner earth. And here they're pretending that we come from this other world, and they give no particulars to their world. Where is it located? How do we get there? Nothing like that. So it begs the question, are they truly ET or they're just more advanced civilization that's living here on earth? Because compared to everything that's going out there, it's like we're like cavemen. We're still driving around chemical-powered cars, and we're still using AC electricity instead of crystal energy. So,
I've had a number of experiences with UFOs, and the one that was most meaningful, because it was so prolonged in the time that I was with them, there was definitely a ship. It was at the beach. I was doing the night maintenance thing. I've told the story many times. And I went to the seawall, and I'm looking over at the seawall to what looks like a saucer-shaped UFO. And you're typing. I can hear you. Not muted.
Sorry.
And what happened was that I could virtually see inside the ship. And the people that were in there were the Nordic-looking people. The white hair thing, even, you know. And there was... I only sensed what was around the woman who was locked into my brain. And there was at least two more people right there. And I believe there was a third and a fourth, but not sort of on, in the same cockpit type of thing, but not right there. It was a weird feeling because I kept trying to kind of like shift my focus to see more, but she kept drawing me back into this beam of telepathic connection. And as I'm talking to her telepathically, the amount of data that was being dropped into my brain, I realized that there was a data dump happening. As a matter of fact, this might be the first time that I was really aware of that sort of situation. And yet I'm having a separate conversation with her. It's almost like there was a dual channel thing happening. You'd have to go a long way to convince me that I didn't see something, you know, that it wasn't a real event. I didn't lose time. I sort of lost time. It was like an hour and a half that I was having this interaction with him, but I was not on the ship. I never lost my position on Earth, and it was an ongoing dialogue. Sometimes I didn't retain the details of the conversation, let me put it to you that way, that I was having with her. I didn't go in, and this, let's see, when would this have been? This would have been probably 1992. And I didn't go in and write it down, you know, because one of the weird things that they said to me, of course I could have, was that they had to leave. They were very specific that they had to leave. And because I was so tied in with her at that point, I was getting subliminal other little messages like, we have to leave because of the geometry of physics that they couldn't stay there anymore in the 3D. And that I had to leave and not look back was what they said. Because I want to see this thing disappear, you know? But no, you just go, turn around, walk into the building, you know, and I'm like feeling like I'm leaving my family. And they said, it will be a very long time before we see each other again. And as I'm walking into the building, she lays one more thing on me. She said, the book you brought in tonight, read it. Now, how the hell did she know I had a book that I just brought in? I hadn't even opened it up yet. And when I did go in and open up that book, it was one of the more ass-kicking books I've ever read. What it was, I'm not sure. I can't actually recall which book it was, but I know it had a green cover. And it could be Godfrey's, what's his name? Oh, dear. I got a copy of it in there.
Godfrey Wright King?
Yes, I think it might have been one
that
of
his. That was a pseudonym. He's the one who wrote all those stories about Germain.
Yes.
Count Germain.
Right. And I think it was his book because of some, now I'm recalling some of the messaging that was, you know, just really important. But, okay, so in my reality, that's a very real situation. It has the earmarks of not being imaginatory in that I wouldn't have imagined the encounter. It was just too bizarre. You know. The other thing that I wouldn't have, I don't believe, imagined, I never lost my, I mean, yeah, I'd done a lot of acid at that point, a lot of LSD, a lot of hallucinogenics, a lot of, you know, crazy ass drugs. And I never felt like I was going into that kind of a mentality. I felt very awake, very aware, and very grounded while all this was happening. And at one point, I sort of disconnected, and I went, "What? This is crazy. What the hell am I doing here?" You know? And I sort of said, "Is this real?" Well, you know the universe, it gives you, oh yeah, we'll talk about that. So the next thing I know, something, I see something on the beach and I look and it's a couple, and this is like 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's a couple walking down the beach and they're walking towards the saucer that's in front of me. And I said, I got all excited. I said, oh, well, if they don't see it, then I'm going to check myself into a psychiatry ward or something, you know, but because there's no way that they wouldn't have been able to see it. And so now I'm focused on watching them, and they're holding hands, and they're kind of staring. I mean, it's dark out, but there was enough starlight, and plus the fact that I'm on the ocean, so the lights are all behind me. And you get some pretty light-looking effects on the beach, you know, at night because of the lights all being behind you on the mainland. So I'm seeing them pretty clearly, and all of a sudden the girl turns, and then she kind of like takes a little start, and she stares at where the ship would be, and then said something to him, and he turned and looked exactly where she was looking, and then he said something to her. And I virtually could either sense or feel that she had shrugged her shoulders. Oh, yeah, maybe you're right. And I'm like, what in the heck? And I turn and I look, and I'm looking at this version of a sailboat with lights on it, like a light on the mast and some in the sort of, you got a shape of a boat. And I'm going like, I've been talking to a sailboat? The hell is this about, right? And I watch these people walk in front of this thing, and as they're walking by it, one after another, the lights all came on, so that by the time they were, you know, 3 feet away from where they had passed it, it was back looking like the UFO. I wouldn't have imagined that. That's not something that I would have made up. That was too weird. So I'm sure it's true. But what was interesting with Jeremy, actually, was his struggling to make... I mean, you give me a story, you know. You say, well, maybe it's the underground people. He was having a hard time even going there. He's, like, questioning the reality of the ETs, but he was doing it in a way that was saying, am I making this up in order to learn? Am I really asleep? And he went back and forth and all around, because I think that this is what's trending, Walt. I think we've gotten to an energy acceleration, if for lack of another term, where we are beginning to perceive the veils. We're beginning to perceive the illusions. Now, that's not the people that are still sleeping and those that aren't aware, you know, but for those people that have been playing this game for a long time or working with Shungite, for one thing, we're at a position now where we're kind of, it's sort of like somebody told us Santa doesn't exist. Now what do you do? You know what I'm saying? You muted? Are you there?
Yep, I was muted.
You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Are you bored?
Well, this is in alignment with, I don't know if you had a chance to see part of it, the Linda Moulton Howe video that I put on Cosmic Reality with the, what do you call it, the meeting in the desert. Thing she did this very year. I think she did it in June.
Did you post that last week, or was it something that you
last
posted?
Week, like, the thing, the Encounter in the Desert conference that she did?
No, I didn't. I didn't listen to it. Dang, it was something I was supposed to do. Yeah, I kept saying, what is it I'm supposed to be listening to, when I was trying to make the tapes for the other voices on Monday? And I should have, I mean, and normally when I'm doing anything on YouTube, Linda comes up for some reason or another, you know? I didn't even see her. Okay, so tell me, talk to me.
Well, it's very, very interesting. She's very thorough in the picture that she paints. She does it's interesting the way that she weaves the story, because she begins in the Antarctic, and at the end of the conference, she's all the way back in the Antarctic. And in the meantime, she's taking you through this journey, piecing together pieces of the puzzle. Spent a lot of time on the Roswell crash because of the significance of what they found there, on where they found the material of the two layers of the skin of the ship. And toward the end of the show, there was one scientist who, working in Area 51 for years, had been following her work and her investigation, because she's been to universities and laboratories, industrial laboratories, to figure out how any of this was done. And like, for example, the outer skin of the ship, she found it was bismuth and magnesium, and she went to an industrial level company that does metallurgy, sophisticated metallurgy. And when she asked, how is this done? Because the layers, it's layers of the material, and the layers are like microns thick. You have to see them with a microscope to see it looks like the layers in a cake. And the engineer that spoke to her, she said, this is impossible. He says, nobody can put together magnesium and bismuth. It's impossible. Nobody can do it. I mean, that's the final say that she got. So at one point in the story, this man contacts her. There's no way that she could even know the existence of this man or even how to reach him. This is one of those guys who had extreme, because she goes on to describe how Area 51 is segmented and segregated and compartmentalized, because you've spoken about that, where you have two people, one chair away from each other, and this guy doesn't know beans what this other guy is doing, and they're like a couple of feet away from each other because everything is so compartmentalized. That's exactly the kind of environment in Area 51. So she describes how you go down so many levels, and then you have to take a different elevator if you want to keep going down. And each time you go down, the deeper you go, the higher that your clearance has to be. So this guy who contacted her was like from the deepest layer. So he's got more clearance even than the president. And he allowed her to record an audio interview. No pictures, nothing, no names, nothing, just audio. And when they talk about this business of the ship, or of what activates the ship, because there's two things that she's been following in the story that she couldn't explain. One was this weird outer skin made of bismuth and magnesium zinc. And the other, something that had been found in other shipwrecks, was aluminum. But the strange thing about the aluminum is that it's 99.99% pure aluminum, which no factory, no human earth factory can produce. But on top of it, the aluminum has 20% monatomic iridium by weight, which something else that no factory can do. You know, where do you get monatomic iridium and mix it in with aluminum, 20% by weight? So this scientist had been working on that, and he knew a lot more than she had been able to discover. So he goes on to explain that. He goes on to explain why the iridium was not detected by the people that analyze the aluminum, because he goes on to explain how you have to carry out the test in order to be able to see it. Otherwise, it bypasses all testing. You don't see the iridium mixed in at the molecular level, mixed in with the aluminum. So he goes on to explain that they don't use the words. He never uses the word scalar, but he describes it to a T. That's what the occupants use to activate the inner skin, because the skin has two layers, this weird outer layer with bismuth and magnesium, zinc, and the inner layer, which is the one with aluminum and iridium. And he says, when they use scalar waves, it activates the inner skin and it cancels out gravity. The thing just floats like a helium balloon, and you can move it with very little energy. You can move this thing at tremendous energies, and the occupants inside experienced no inertia, meaning that you could do a 90-degree turn, 10,000 miles an hour, and your body would feel nothing at all, because that inertia is canceled out, and it's just floating in null gravity. So, but the trick is, he says, in order to activate it with scalar waves, you need to generate scalar waves in the terahertz range, meaning trillions of cycles per second, which is the range of visible light. And that goes on to explain why many people, when they have seen UFOs, they report seeing an extremely bright light, almost like sunlight. That's because it's the outer skin. The outer skin begins that they confirmed that in one of the laboratories that she went. I don't know how what they did with that little piece that she was able to get. I don't know how they charged it or what they treated it with, but they found that it was actually producing light. So the scientist explains that once it gets the inner skin is activated with scalar waves, the outer skin begins to emit light. And she says, but that isn't that dangerous at that frequency, those kinds of waves? And he goes, exactly, it's very dangerous. It breaks up DNA. And that's why in many places where people have described UFOs landing, when they come in and investigate the area, you find these patches of radioactive ash because that's terahertz level, you know, scalar waves. They literally just disintegrate, you know, living matter. So it's very interesting. And she goes on to say she never had a chance to physically interview or over the phone Neil Armstrong, but she did have a chance to sit down and had a one-to-one conversation with one of his closest and best friends, someone who had been in the service with him, and why when he came back, he was psychologically broken because he was so disappointed discovering all the lies he had been fed. They were never briefed. They knew what they were going to encounter in the moon. They purposely never briefed them so that they could at least have a heads up. You know, guys, this is what you're going to see when you get there. No, they didn't do that. So that part is really interesting. But here's the part where I think it kind of meshes with what this other gentleman said about the black goo, how the black goo, you know, disconnects you from your higher centers. And a person becomes, instead of being a human being, it becomes a human animal. You know, all your higher attributes are lost, like compassion, appreciation, gratitude, love. All these things are lost because they're shut down and you're just a walking animal. She gives a lot of evidence. She had, you know, photos and photos of letters that there is a hidden war. Besides, you know, we know what Fulford has been saying, that we're in the middle of a not readily visible civil war because it's not being fought on the streets with guns. But through all the things that happened ever since 47 when the Roswell crash happened, the government at the time, little by little, they became aware that they were smack in the middle of a war between alien civilizations, because she tells the story of when a military commander encountered one of these tall beings that was actually working to help humanity. And then there's the encounters with the negative beings that are, you know, reptilian in nature. So she says right now, we're in the middle of this war between these two factions that, you know, they're both alien factions. We know ones want to help humanity, others don't care to help humanity. So she goes on to explain how a multitude of Air Force pilots have been lost to bad and negative UFOs. They have literally, you know, shot pilots down that have gone out to investigate some radar signature or some weird activity in the sky, and they've been shot down. So she said the officers have to face the task of, you know, writing letters to their families explaining, you know, why somebody in, you know, a veteran pilot with a fully perfectly working machine, you know, why did they die? You know, what happened that they're, you know, that now I'm getting a casket here with the remains of my husband's or my brother's body or something. She says, so they have a really tough task before them. And she goes on to say, she quoted the person and the year, some group in the government that they were advocating for the public to know these things. She says, but at the time they chose caution, that the public was not ready to become aware that we're like between a rock and a hard place. You know, yes, there are these ETs that want to help us and protect us wherever they can, but then you have this other group of ETs that couldn't care less. You know, they're the ones behind the cattle mutilations. She goes on to describe where she tells stories of things that have happened in Iraq and in Afghanistan where soldiers that were killed, the skull and the spine were literally torn out of the body, like you see in that scene in the movie Predator, you know, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where the Predator does that to each trophy kill that he makes. She describes that as actually happening, not movie material. And she says, these are these creatures. So she says, I have compassion for the government that they have to deal with this information and there's no public to share it with. Now, in my opinion, I get it. Caution is never a bad thing, but if you enlist the consciousness of the collective, you'll resolve things faster. Because now you're bringing all that consciousness to bear and you can turn this war in a heartbeat. Because imagine if 7 billion people started thinking, okay, we don't, no more negative ETs, no more alien goo. Okay, goodbye. They can't stay. But if you're keeping it a secret and there's only a limited group of people aware of this, you're stuck in this balance of power. So it's worth, despite everything I've said, I've only even touched the surface of it. You who have been in the military would appreciate a lot of the material that she got from military sources, letters and redacted stuff.
I may just do that after the show.
I mean, for something, when I looked at the counter, I thought, oh, 2 hours and 47 minutes. I saw it in one sitting. I don't know where the time went. I had no problem watching the whole thing in one sitting. I was engrossed in the information she was giving. It was never, ever, ever boring at any time.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen so much information about this. Sometimes you think, oh, again with a UFO. No, this was different. So.
Interesting. Well, I'm so glad that she, I mean, you have to honor the woman. You know, I mean, I've been at this for probably as long as she has, but she has been in the public for that whole time. No. I'm still hiding in the background, you know? It's like, wow. It's truly an amazing journey she's been on. Sweet lady, too, it seems like. I mean, she has her cats on her videos. Can't be all bad. So
did you get the Fulford report? I sent it to you on.
I know, but I didn't. I didn't read it. I've been
okay.
A little bit busy.
Did you finish the catio at least?
Finish the what?
The catio.
Oh yes, the catio. Yes, it's such a funny thing because, it's about 4 feet. What was it? 5 feet. It's 5 feet tall, and then you know 10 feet, and it's the what they call hardware fencing. It's very small, half inch openings in it. You know, instead of chain link. And when I first started it, they were small enough that those little suckers, they could get their heads in there, you know. I don't think they could get their shoulders through, but I never knew what they were going to do. So I went with the more expensive stuff, but under the assumption it was also going to be able to make it, work it, you know. But, oh, no. It turns out that stuff does not have any kind of precision in it. So, and when I'm telling Peter the situation, he says, oh, yeah, you have to put a pulley up and pull. And I'm going, oh, God, you know. So the whole effect is kind of like this. I said to people, it looks like a 70-year-old woman built this without help. But, okay, so I finish it. I close up everything. And to get... there's a this room started out as a screen room, and now it's a fully, you know, enclosed room, but it doesn't have any kind of wall. It's basically plywood, right? And so it was easy to cut the hole in the wall, so it's up like, you know, well, two stacks of milk cartons makes it even, okay? So I put these two stacks of milk cartons up. I've got everything. I've got the door in. And the door is at that moment closed, and it's cat door, little cat door, you know. And then I pound the rest of the fence in, you know, because there's no door yet, because I don't know exactly what's going to happen. I wasn't going to spend the time building one. So I put the, you know, and then as I'm walking away from it, I said, those milk cartons, those kittens are going to knock over. I need to go back in there. But I was, something was happening. Maybe I was just tired. So I go into the house, and by the time I got into the house, the most curious of the cats was already going, you know, looking out there, and, you know, I guess I had opened it. Before I closed it up, I opened it up, because she took 5 minutes to get through that opening. You know, it's a dual opening. It's like, you know, 5 inches or 4 inches, probably. But, you know, but right away she took to it. And her brother was like, oh, what are you doing there? Whop, he's out, right? But the other two, the mama and the cat that's called Bingo, the one that was called Dolly by me, but Jean said, no, her name is Bingo. She took probably 5 days before she finally went out. The door was open. They didn't have to walk through anything. Initially, I just kept it open. And mom was like, oh, thank you for building that. Now I've got some peace and quiet in here. She had no interest of going out. And then one day she did go out. And 10 days into the, you know, being there, she did go out. And she seemed to be having a good time. She was out there for most of the day. And then she came into the house and said, well, that was nice. She hasn't left since. But she's getting pudgy. You know, I feel bad putting, you know, if I put enough food, so I think the kittens are okay. There's too much. She gets bored, she eats. So.
Oh, introduce her. I know. Buy her an iPad. That'll keep her busy.
Oh, that's funny. Oh my God. But yes, it's actually, we're very happy with it. And plus, one of the reasons I did it was so that the cats and the dog could see each other and get used to each other while there's a separation. You know what I'm saying?
But there's a roof, right? It doesn't get rained on?
Oh, no. If it rains, they go in the house.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't about to put a roof on it, no. But they, you know, and it's funny because that's working. The little guy out, the little boy, he'll sit out there and watch the dog when I'm out there with the dog. I haven't seen the girls doing that yet, but he's like more curious. What is that thing? It's kind of big. But yeah, it was one of those things that I'm so glad I did. You know, it was an experience. But next time, I think I'll ask somebody to help me. It seems so simple to begin with, you know, but. And I told you that one of my problems was I'm going like, why is it taking me so long? And I realized it's because I need my glasses for everything. So the glasses kept falling down. I couldn't do the screwdriver thing, which I used to be able to do fine without glasses. And so adjusting my glasses probably put 2 days on the whole thing.
You don't have those things for runners, that the thing that holds the glasses to your face?
Next time I have to do something like this, you're damn certain that I'm going to get one of them. I think I'll order it on eBay. Oh, my God. Because, I mean, I finally did think that in my head. How can I make one of those, you know? But by then I was so close, I just toughed it out. But it took me so long to figure it out. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, we're going to do Ben when we come back. We've got like 5 minutes here. So Jeremy's search for what's really happening is taken, in my opinion, kind of a step up. And it was interesting listening to him because it was sort of the same thing that I was going through when I was listening to us talking, you know, 4 years ago. And that was, what are we doing here? Because it's that morphing. I'm feeling like and I've said this, you know, that every time you get to a point where you kind of are knowing what you're supposed to be doing, or you think you've got a handle on it, all of a sudden it morphs and there's something to, you go, wait a minute, that wasn't here 5 minutes ago. You know what I'm saying? So I think we're in a process of really intense changing in I think the collective consciousness is already adjusted, but that we as human beings are going through a very swift readjustment of perspective. We're seeing things differently, sort of like in the Matrix, you know? It's like everything looks one way, but then all of a sudden it looks a different way simply because you've adjusted the way you're looking at it.
Well, all the rules of the old reality are collapsing, so this is, you're just looking at the tip of the iceberg. It's going to get more intense because everything, all the rules that people took for granted. Oh, this is the way it's supposed to be. Oh, this isn't life. No, it's all going away. No, life is not supposed to be that way. You're not supposed to be a slave for 70 years, and when there's no more life left in you here, retire. No, that's not the way life's supposed to be. So all of that, all reality, it's going away. It has to go away. Just because we accepted it as, oh, well, that's the way life is. No, that doesn't mean it's right. It was imposed on us. And our energy and our consciousness was harvested to keep sustaining it. And that's what's happening. People are unplugging from the Matrix. They're saying, wait, I don't want to feed this anymore. I don't want to support this anymore. I want my reality, the reality where I'm happy, not when I'm making some corporation happy. And that's the notion that people are waking, even if they do nothing about it, the very fact that they're seeing that notion and accepting it, that's making the change, because it's the rules of quantum mechanics. Just watching the experiment, even if you have no vested interest in how it turns out, just by watching it, now you've changed it.
Yeah, and let me ask you something about the Matrix, because I've seen, I guess there's 3 or 4 movies. I'm not even sure. I think there's 4.
There's 3 movies and 1 anime, and there's animated versions.
Okay, so it was a trilogy type of thing, right?
Yeah.
The movies? Well, I had a, I don't think I understood the Matrix. I could understand, okay, they basically were using human beings almost like a battery thing.
Right.
I'm not exactly sure, who was at the core of the, what was the source of the Matrix complex? In other words, was it an AI?
Correct. It's an AI. You know, it's made up of all the machines. It's a freestanding movie, which is a compendium of Matrix stories, and it's valuable because they actually show you the history in animated film. They show you how it came to be, how the Matrix, you know, evolved into what it is at the time that Neo comes into the story. So that's really interesting, because now you understand why all those people are on all those bathtubs plugged into the system. But the thing is that in the movies themselves, what you're seeing is that the AI could never understand or deal with the human spirit. You know, it had no problem dealing with the mechanics of the human, you know, the human body, its drives, it needs food, it needs sex, it needs entertainment. It understood all that stuff, but it could not deal with the human spirit, because the human spirit knows that something is wrong. something is not right. This thing that I call life, it's not 100%, and they couldn't, that's the anomaly that they couldn't account for. So what they did is they let the story play out where the anomaly is rebelling against, you know, people have been escaping from the Matrix. They're hiding in this underground city called Zion. And I don't know in their time, you know, if it happens once a century or when it happens, you know, the anomaly manifests, which is like Neo is like the compendium of all these restless souls that know that something is wrong. And it manifests, and this baby is born, and he wakes up, and he has all these powers because he sees things for what they are, a computer program, not true reality. So in order to deal with this, they let the anomaly exist. The anomaly leads this revolution, and then the machines come over, and they destroy Zion, and they subjugate all those so-called liberated humans. And they just leave a small amount of, and then the whole system resets, and it goes back another 100 years until the anomaly is born again. And that's why when Neo meets with the architect, he sees all the other Neos on the screen. Those were all the guys that he was in the past. But now, you know, the story takes a different turn. It's moving away from that resetting of the system to undoing it all, because one of the things, this is my understanding of, and if people have seen the trilogy, please correct me, the purpose of the Oracle, because you had the architect, which is the sum total maximum logic machine. He's all science, all mechanics, all complete logic, you know, zero heart, zero soul, zero spirit, zero compassion, just pure, undiluted reason. And then you have the other program, the Oracle. The Oracle, represented by a female, is the one program written to take into account the human spirit and how marvelous it is and how mysterious it is. That's why in the first movie, you see she's the one dealing with these special kids, like the kid bending the spoon and the kids moving things where they're mine, because that's her capability. She was written to take that into account. Well, now, you know, at the end of the trilogy, because Neo successfully broke out of the Matrix, and the ship that he was piloting was going straight for the heart of the machine world, and I forget now when he was plugged in and he had the what can I say, like the whole heart of the machine civilization manifested itself as a giant face made up of all these individual machines. So he had a dialogue with the machine, and that's where the decision was made to liberate humanity from the Matrix, because they had reached a point in their evolution where it was just pointless. And also interesting that in that last third movie, the ship is able to break through that perpetual cloud cover. And for the first time, Neo and Trinity are able to see the sun, because that's what the machines did. They created a perpetual cloud cover, so nobody could use solar energy anymore. So that was at the end. And so the very last scene in the film, as I saw it on the theaters, was a dialogue between the Oracle and the architect, where the Oracle said, "Are you going to free all the people that are plugged into the Matrix?" And the architect turns around and says, "Of course I am. What do you think I am, a human?" He didn't have the highest esteem for human beings. Meaning he would not go back on his word. He said he would do it, and he would do it because he's not a human. So that was the last scene in the film.
That's a wild comparison to what's happening now.
And that's also, it kind of dovetails the representation of an AI that Anelia makes in that book, The Return. That AI was all about life. It loved life. I mean, it cared for those animals like they were his own blood and flesh and blood. That's why he wasn't angry at the scientists that were there with the main character. Why were they taking so many hummingbirds? They're an integral part of the ecosystem in this base. You should not be taking. So he had to change the orders to have the scientific crew take only the bare minimum that they needed for study and leave everything else intact, because the ecosystem there was of critical importance, and this AI would take nothing less than leave the stuff alone. These ecosystem has been evolving for centuries. Don't take so many samples. Don't take so many plants. So don't take so many. So this AI was furious, was militant about protecting life. Didn't want to destroy life.
Very interesting. We're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we'll do a little Fulford, hey? Sound good?
Hey.
All right. We'll be right back.
Off we go.
And welcome back to the Cosmic Reality Radio Show. It's produced by Cosmic Reality Radio. My name is Nancy Hopkins. With me is Walt Silva, my co-host for about 4 years. And also it's December 4th, 2018. So, Walter. Fulford.
Okay, that's where I'm going.
It's been. I want to tell you something. Q posted and said to watch.
Did you see that thread I sent you?
Which one?
That Q thread.
When did you send
that long? I sent it to you and Derek.
Oh yes, I was reading it, but it was so long. I don't even know how. All of a sudden, I said, "How long is this?" And I looked, and I was like a fraction of the way through it. Yeah. But he had told people to watch Hannity. Last night, was it? Or night before? But what happened? Oh, Monday. It was Monday. What's today? Tuesday. So it was yesterday. Okay, so he tells people, watch Hannity's show. And that was on at 9 o'clock last night. So Dolly and I get all excited, you know, and we go over there and watch it. And I'm going, Dolly, I don't know if I can take much more of this, you know, burying George Bush, who killed me in a, you know, killed Kennedy in another...
Yeah,
I mean, it was just like this whole thing is kind of disturbing, but anyway, then she comes back to me and she said, "Q just posted that Fox stopped the interview with whoever was supposed to be on." So I don't know what happened, you know, but whatever was supposed to be announced yesterday on Fox didn't happen. So have you seen anything today that looks like something?
Well, Fulford has something interesting to say about Bush.
Okay, good.
So, okay. So the title of this report, which is dated yesterday, the title is, "In Historic Move, P2 Freemasons, the Black Sun Worshippers, Sue for Peace." In what future historians will look back on as a huge watershed event, the P2 Freemasons, Worshippers of the Black Sun, and creators of both fascism and communism, are suing for peace. White Dragon Society sources say, this, coming with the removal of the Rothschild family from control of central banks, means the world is about to enter uncharted historical waters. The P2 Freemasons are proposing that the world be led by a triumvirate of the Sons of the Black Sun, the Sons of Big Horus, and Sons of the Dragon, according to the proposal conveyed by Vincenzo Mazzara, a cavalier of the Teutonic Knights and the most senior P2 member to contact the White Dragon Society. The Sons of the Black Sun refers to the P2 Freemasons who give orders to the Pope and the world's 1.5 million or so Catholics. The Sons of Big Horus refers to the eye at the top of the pyramid in the U.S. $1 bill, presumably referring to non-P2 Freemasons such as the Scott Rite and Grand Orient, who control much of the English and French-speaking world. The Sons of the Dragon refers to Asian secret societies who control most of Asia. At this point, most readers are probably, and rightly so, appalled at the idea of three secret societies colluding in order to continue to rule in secret. The White Dragon Society, of course, wants everything to be open and with full public participation. Nonetheless, the P2 are powerful. They told us in advance they were going to fire Pope Maledict, that was Benedict XVI, and they did so. The P2 also bragged to the WDS that they were the ones responsible for staging the March 11, 2011 Fukushima tsunami and nuclear mass murder terror incident. Thus, the fact they are now suing for peace means they know the dragnet is finally closing in on them. This move, I'm going to capture this image and put it on chat because the folks on chat are going to want to see this. It's something that Trump tweeted. Okay. Okay, so let's grab the photo. Okay, there is the photo. This move is also intimately related to the announcement that Nazi Fourth Reich Führer George H.W. Scherf Bush, in parentheses, is dead. As Pentagon sources put it, while the G20 was prepping the world for a global currency reset, the 41st President Bush Sr. expired on 11/30, because 11 plus 30 equals 41. In fact, Bush Sr. died in June, but the announcement was delayed until all the preparations were made to arrest senior Zionist Khazarian Mafia underlings like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, the sources say. This is why U.S. President Donald Trump retweeted this famous image on November 27th with the label, Now that Russia collusion is a proven lie, when do the trials for treason begin? And that's the photo I just put on chat. The answer to that question, Pentagon sources say, is that mass arrests may occur after the Bush funeral, as Gitmo is overstaffed and Trump may initiate military tribunals before the new Congress is seated on January the 3rd, 2019. The official announcement of the Bush Sr. death is important because, unlike other members of his group, such as Hillary Clinton or Bush Jr., Bush Sr. had a lot of clout and respect at the top of the U.S. military-industrial complex. With him gone, they have lost their last line of protection. As far as a eulogy is concerned, since readers can find out for themselves about his involvement in things like the Kennedy assassination, I will only mention a few bits of original intelligence I have from my own sources about this man. The first, from MI6, is that when he went fishing in May, in Maine, in July 2007 with Russian President Vladimir Putin, Bush proposed they start a new Cold War, with Russia pretending to be China's ally. Using this Cold War as camouflage, the G7, Russia and Japan, would increase their military budgets until they all turned around to attack China and divided into six countries. Certainly, until recently, that was the plot being followed with all the fake anti-Russian hysteria in the corporate media. Also, P2 Freemasons told me back in 2009 that Bush was the leader of the faction that wanted to kill 90% of humanity, the so-called useless eaters, enslave the rest, and create a Nazi eco-paradise. My X-File sources, meanwhile, tell me the Bush who died was actually clone number 34. As evidence, he provided a link to a video showing old man Bush choking while allegedly eating sushi and actually dying as his wife Barbara finished him off with a poisoned cloth. This was January the 8th, 1992. He was quickly replaced with a new clone already waiting in the back room, a fast switch of clones slash doubles. This was prepared in advance, and he provides a YouTube link to that. This writer for years has asked contacts inside the Japanese public NHK broadcaster to get a copy of the original tape of this incident, but apparently it is kept under lock and key. As a final comment, when this writer approached Bush Sr. for an interview, I was told he was retired and did not do interviews, but that he knew about and supported what I was trying to do. In other words, he appears to have changed his mind about the genocide and agreed to the alternative plan of a huge campaign to fix the planet, followed by human expansion into the universe. This brings us back to the P2 Freemason peace overtures mentioned above. The P2 now say their proposed triumvirate will guide us into the new era with a new Yalta already in being. Yalta, you may recall, was the 1945 conference between Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, and Joseph Stalin that decided the shape of the post-war world. The new Yalta, according to the P2, is an agreement to finance a multi-hundred-trillion-dollar project to build a huge spaceship to ferry us to other planets as part of a project that has already been developed by NASA. Of course, U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency sources have previously told us NASA stands for Not a Space Agency. So these claims need to be taken with extreme skepticism. The other thing that P2 had to say was that the world financial system has been able to create financial debts of 1.4 quadrillion against the world GDP of less than 100 trillion. This is a monster that no central bank algorithm can control. They know it well, both the FRB and the ECB, but also the Chinese. This is the result of a devastating financial war between Asia and the West, leading to the continuous creation of new money in a way that is designed only to explode the financial system. As a peace offering, the P2 are offering this bond, and there's a picture of a bond, backed by 46,000 tons of gold. Despite this peace offering, the fact is that the P2 and their fellow secret societies have been extremely incompetent at ruling this planet and have presided over human misery, endless wars, and the destruction of much of the natural world. That's why, instead of accepting their triumvirate, we need to keep fighting until there is total unconditional surrender. On that front, a major Khazarian cabal attempt to start World War III was prevented last week. There is no Hanukkah miracle this year after an Israeli false flag against the U.S. Navy that was to be blamed on Iran was stopped, say Pentagon sources. Presumably, this has something to do with the news that Vice Admiral Scott Sterny, who oversaw U.S. naval forces in the Middle East, was found dead Saturday in an apparent suicide. This incident, combined with the Mossad laser pointers targeting him last week, means that Trump may now be ready to declassify not just FISA, but JFK and 9/11 files to terminate Israel and the Bush cabal, the sources say. Israel is up against the ropes because its Air Force missiles, paper dome, and lobby are useless as the UN General Assembly demands the return of Golan, they continue. Regime change is expected in both Israel and its client state, Saudi Arabia, as patriots in both countries seek world help to remove Benjamin Netanyahu and his pet so-called Mohammed bin Salman, they say. A sign of this was when Trump refused to meet Mohammed bin Salman at the just-concluded G20 meeting. Also, the Israeli police have recommended indicting Netanyahu for multiple crimes, and his downfall is just a matter of time. Pentagon sources say the International Criminal Court is joining Argentine prosecutors as they look into war crime charges against MBS, the EU, and the UN, and this may implicate Israel because they nuked Yemen. The other Hazarian mafia thug facing removal is French Rothschild slave president Emmanuel Macron. Mass demonstrations to oust Macron continue to rage across France, with 84% of the public supporting the demonstrators. The Macron regime's thugs are using agent provocateurs to create violent incidents as an excuse to declare martial law. However, French protesters have posted a video that proved the violent protesters actually work for the police. When Macron declares martial law, the French military may side with the yellow vests, the protesters, to oust this Rothschild puppet, the Pentagon sources say. French opposition sources, for their part, say that Macron has hired over 10,000 foreign mercenaries to protect himself, and that the French military are going to use this foreign incursion as a pretext to move against him. Another Rothschild criminal puppet to be removed soon is Japanese finance minister Taro Aso, Japanese right-wing sources say. Aso has infuriated right-wingers by promising to sell off all of Japan's water resources to benefit his son-in-law, Alexander the Rothschild. Aso's death has already been ordered, and if he's not dead already, he will be soon. a right-wing source close to the imperial family, said. The arrest of Nissan president Carlos Ghosn is part of the campaign to remove French Rothschild influence from that country, the sources say. Trump told Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at the G20 that he favors a strong Japan and the rebalancing of the Nissan-Renault alliance, Pentagon sources say. Since Japan's GDP is almost twice that of France, and since Nissan's market capitalization is almost twice that of Renault, France will be forced to sell or reduce its stake, they add. Finally, there's also some sort of esoteric California-style battle involving directed energy weapons taking place in Australia. Australian intelligence sent us the following pictures of what appears to be massive DEU attack that is starting fires in Queensland. Things are definitely heating up, and we can expect a lot more as the battle to free humanity rages toward victory and freedom from Babylonian death slavery and towards a golden age. That's it. So I'm going to grab this image and put it on chat.
Australian fires. I had not heard anything about that.
According to him, it's Australian intelligence that sent him this photo. One of the photos looks like the thing that I've seen YouTube videos of, what they call the fire tornadoes. Fire tornadoes. When there's a fire and you have the wind forming into a tornado and it pulls up like a column of fire.
Right, yes, yes. They call them fire tornadoes. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's some Greek thing happening, too. I'm just looking at what's coming up. I put in Australian fires, DEW. Yeah, there's a whole... December 1st. Let's just look at this thing. It's called Chemtrail Planet. It's, oh, Jesus. A lot of words, Walter. Oh, my God. I'm trying to get the screen bigger so I can read it. There we go.
And this okay. is the link that he gave to the YouTube video where he claims that the actual Bush senior died eating sushi and his wife finished him off with a poison cloth. The guy they buried, according to him, is clone, according to his X-File sources, clone number 34. So this is the YouTube link.
Click on that while I'm here. I just put in the article on the fires in the DEW. Okay, something's not working on this thing. Needs refreshing, probably. I get lost. Okay, here we go. All right, directed energy weapons. All right, okay. The fires and let's just see what I gotta blow it up again. My God. Okay. What about 2018? Oh yeah, this is big. This is a big article. I am not even gonna pretend to try to read this. Oh, but they've got a whole bunch of pictures. See, it was interesting in that when the fires started and they started talking about DEW,
mm-hmm.
It's the same damage being done as was done on 9/11. That was the key, that it wasn't some other thing. It was actually DEW, because there's no doubt I've been a professional researcher for 40 years, and the case for DEW being used in 9/11 is, I don't think that it can be disputed. It's that firm. So if you know that DEW was responsible, that's called direct energy weapons. If you've got the proof that DEW looks like this particular situation, and then you start seeing it in California, like right now I've got a picture up, And there's a gas station, fully intact. None of the trees in any, I don't see any tree damage. Maybe one over there, but virtually no tree damage. And yet there is a building that the only thing apparently standing is a brick facade on it. And it's like it's melted into the ground. Just like you saw in 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why there's so many people out there that are looking at the situation in a very different way because of the peculiar aspects of the fire burns. Now, here's another picture. It's like you're in a helicopter looking down at a highway, and I posted it in chat. Actually, I can tell you, it's chemtrailplanet.com/dew.html. If you're out there, it's going to be on the YouTube below, but chemtrailplanet.com/dew.html. It's a picture looking down on a highway, and you see all these cars. Like, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. One's got a trailer, 14. One's got a boat, 15, 16, I guess, because there's a huge ball of fire. And what you see here is that this is supposedly caused by forest fires, but there is no forest fire around them. You know how a highway is, right?
But look at the line on the highway. You can see like something, some giant beam swept across the highway, and all those cars in the path are the ones that are burned. All the ones that are not in the path of the beam are okay.
The one that isn't in the path is the boat. But a boat has an open engine and normally gasoline on the boat. Okay, so that exploding like that, because the car obviously isn't hurt and the front part of the boat isn't. But this is very clearly the same thing that happened on 9/11. Fitzgerald Boulevard or something. I'm not sure, but Fitzgerald, and it was like I think it was. Oh gosh, my details here aren't coming. I think it was a mile and a half from the actual Twin Towers attack, and you saw cars parked along this expressway, and there was cars that were burnt, and the next one was fine. You had cars that had the front end of the car was completely gone and the back looked pristine. It's the same kind of damage you're saying, but now that you point out that it's almost like a scar mark right across the highway.
Yeah.
It's pretty phenomenal. So when you see these kind of pictures, look at these, and then there's a picture of a zapped rabbit causing it to freeze in mid-hop. I mean, it's that one you don't want to look at. So in my opinion, yeah, it looks like DEW to me. Absolutely.
Now, the problem is that with the Twin Towers, it wasn't even in normal language. It didn't even exist. The notion of it was like reserved for movies.
I will point.
Nobody went there.
I will point out that in my opinion, Dr. Judy Woods, who's the woman who wouldn't let it go and broke the information and the science, is an American and a world hero. And someday the world is going to say thank you, thank you, thank you. Because we now see it, just like you say. Nobody was putting this out there. She was. Only her. I mean, I believed at the time that I ran into Judy Wood's research, I believed wholeheartedly it was a controlled demolition. I was writing a book about it. And then I see those cars on Fitzgerald Parkway, and I was like, no, this is not natural. And that's when I started paying attention to what she was saying. And that was like opening up a whole different look at our reality here. You know, if they've got these the capability to do direct weaponing of this sort, whoever they are, because I do believe there were two players. I do believe that the towers were designed to come down from a fail-safe, maybe, but probably a controlled and intentional demolition. Because initially, I was looking at the very first fact was that there was smoke being burped out of the towers, and it was white smoke. And the only way you get white smoke like that is when you're putting an explosive charge in concrete. It's a telltale sign of a concrete, something just blew up concrete, a white trail. And I'm going like, whoa. And then there were so many other things, the firefighters reporting they were hearing explosions, you know, just before the towers come down. The case was made, in my opinion. But then I start seeing this weird science. And now, because of her, we know what to look for. And it's not just the people that understand DEW and the telltale signs of it. This was the people on the ground going, that doesn't make sense. Because it was in their faces, whereas it was actually buried in the 9/11 event. That's one of the reasons they got the all the rubble out of there as fast as they could and told them that they sent it to China.
Too much forensic evidence.
Well, no, there was no evidence. There was no metal, because when you're using a DEW, just like those pictures are showing you, you don't have the metal structure. In a fire... Well,
what's missing is the forensic evidence. That there you have it. You know, someone is going to look at what's left, and they're going to say, okay, what's missing? So that is a smoking gun, from my point of view, because, well, oh, wait a minute, there's no metal? What do you...
Well, that was the thing about the towers, okay? Now, let's just take the second tower hit, the first one to fall. It was hit at the 78-79 floors. And so you've got 77 floors that are crashing. On top of that, you've got it's a 110-floor building. So everything is coming down, according to what they told us happened. That the fire started, the building, the top, those floors collapsed, allowing the, you know, 30 floors above to hit the ones below, and that they pancaked down. That's what they said. Okay, assuming that was correct, which of course it isn't, don't you think you would have a rubble pile that was a little bit more than 7 feet, 7 stories? Oh. So you go from 110.
When I saw that photo, I couldn't believe the rubble pile was so low.
It went from 110 floors to 7 floors. How is that possible? You see, there were so many very in-your-face telltale signs of what was not right, and because there wasn't any guru there on the talking heads to say, "Oh my God, that doesn't make any sense." They were all reading from script. Don't say it. I mean, like, it's preposterous. And so the rest of us out there saying to people, my gosh, look at this thing. This is an impossible situation. Like, one of the things that I didn't get in my book, because I never heard it until after it was published, but the best way to prove our point here is that, okay, supposedly they're pancaking down. So essentially, the floor above is hitting the floor below. So like a clap of hands. Well, let's see you clap your hands 77 times in 10 seconds. That's supposedly how long it took for the building to disappear. And people say the building fell in 10 seconds. No, it disappeared in 10 seconds. Nothing hit the ground. There was no seismic response to the supposed falling buildings. Period. I mean, it's insane when you see the data, and yet this BS...
It was almost like the collapse of a hollow shell.
Because what does a DEW do? It's a direct energy weapon. So it does the same thing it does to you when it's 5G. But let's not go into that. Okay, so what you've got is you you hit it, you hit, it's just basic science, I mean physics, your music, energy, you hit the building in a frequency that disrupts the molecular cohesion of the material itself. And there were so many pictures and video taken of like beams, steel beams just falling into dust. That's exactly what was happening. Right before the buildings went down, and some of you remember, but maybe not too many of you, right before the buildings fell down, the buildings themselves seemed to be almost, there was all this white fumes, it wasn't even fumes, it was like this curdling white stuff all over it, like it was boiling or something. Well, that was actually the concrete cooking. And after the concrete came the metal. And then once the metal was gone, boom, it just disappeared. It didn't fall. It disappeared in 10 seconds. And another thing, Walt, in the 7 stories that remained, they never found a door handle. They never found a filing cabinet. There was one filing cabinet that was found. And it was known to be a filing cabinet because what they found was a molten metal about the size of a basketball. But inside of this, you could see file folders. You could see it was a file. That was the only metal object that they actually found, was that thing. All the metal was gone except some of this, some of the outside structure that was there on one sides of the building. And I mean, some of the one side of the building is completely gone, and then there's this other stuff, but that was on the other side of the building. It never quite got there. But then it kept cooking, and it was disappearing. They didn't send it to China. The damn stuff disappeared because they couldn't stop it. That was the thing. They couldn't stop it. And Wood gets into a fascinating discussion about Deutschland. Is it, isn't that the bank? Deutschland, is it? What, the German bank, the big one?
Deutsche Bank?
Deutsche Bank, okay. Across from where the Twin Towers went down, and if I'm remembering correctly, the Fitzgerald Parkway is on the other side of this building, away from the towers. Okay, so it's likely that if the parkway was being attacked, was somehow being infected because of the beam, perhaps this bank was also. Well, they built this bank, the building up of this bank. Now, why did they have to build? Something was, somehow it was damaged. They had to do this building replacement, repairs on this building. And as soon as they got it done, the metal started disintegrating, like turning to rust. And that was one of the, you remember it took them, what, 3 months to clean out the place, and it took them 10 years to build? You know what that was all about?
No.
The materials, there was a residual field of the DEW happening. Everything was still in a discordant resonance, and they didn't know how to turn it off. So every time they tried to build anything, it turned to rust.
Oh, wow.
And one of the, well, that was another thing about the whole event. On the parkway and in parking lots around the area, there were cars that were completely rusted out. In weeks. That's impossible.
Well, not if you accelerate the entropy.
Exactly. So somehow, and the other thing that Wood got into was that, well, if you're having some kind of an energetic or a radiation effect that you can't control, what would you do to try to stop it? And her mind went to dirt. Bury it. Right? And so then she started looking at pictures, available pictures, and she found out that there were dozens and dozens of dump trucks bringing dirt into the area. Okay, well, okay, that's for construction. You know, they took out all the rubble and it's for just construction. Well, then why did they take out dirt the next day? And she was able to show pictures of these trailer trucks going into the area with dirt and then coming back out of the area with dirt. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
Well, that's the problem with concrete. Concrete is not grounding material. You could have a piece of metal embedded in some concrete, a pillar or foundation or something. It's not grounded. So there's nothing to discharge into. I don't know if you know this, but concrete is an insulator. Even though it's mineral and it has salts and all that, it does not conduct electricity. That's why it's so bad to live on a house where the floor is concrete or the foundations are, because you're completely disconnected from earth ground. You need a specific design that things done to it so that you can be ground to place. Otherwise, you're isolated. So it's a great way to destroy the metal, because whatever you're shooting at the metal, it's not going to ground. It's going to stay in the metal until the metal disintegrates.
Exactly. I went to the grounding too. But they didn't, you know, the people that are working in construction there have no clue as to what's really happening. You know, so whoever figures out, oh, we got to ground out the whole thing. Because if you've got just one area that's still resonating, it's all going to start resonating that way. You know, because it's a higher octave of resonation. And it's like the middle C. Resonance. Well, I make up words, you know that.
That's the Hopkins Dyslexia Special. 2 for 1 this month.
Absolutely. No, I don't know what the California fires are all about, but he alluded to it, Fulford did, that it's still part of that war that's happening.
Right? Well, the thing is that up to what point the cabal is able to finance anything at all, because if this banking family is being shoved out of the banking business, and that's the first domino to go down, they're running on fumes. But what's happening actually was described in those books that were written in the 1970s, 1980s. I don't remember how many years they were channeling, the Law of One books. For people that have read the 5 books, when Don Elkins was asking questions about, you know, this negative faction of humanity, Ra said, they will be defeated, but they're not going down without a fight. And it's playing out. They have the water up to their noses in every direction, but they're still, you know, scratching and biting and barking. So I guess they're going to blow their last dollar on some crazy maneuver.
Or it's in war, apparently, there's collateral damage. And perhaps because of the oddity of the path that these fires are taking, it's like burning a path for this high train thing, the fast train thing. You know, that there's that conspiracy.
Oh, yeah. I read an article saying that how coincidental that the properties that are being destroyed are properties where they want to run some high-speed train.
Exactly. And then there's the gold reserve under the town of Paradise. And supposedly the entire hill there is full of gold. And they've known that forever, and that the people there won't sell their property. But now they don't have property to sell, a piece of earth. But it's just, you know, fascinating how many different stories are coming out of this. And it seems to me that if the cabal has DEW, certainly the white hats have DEW. And I'm just wondering, is there collateral damage? And they're really after a whole enclave of these dark energy people. I'm wondering who is really being burnt out. Not where, but who. Because you know they like to get, they're kind of hive mentality, to be honest with you. And they like to get in groups and move together. You know, in Paraguay, you got the Bush compound, and next door you got the German chancellor there.
What's, yeah, but name? There's no, remember, loyalty is not an attribute of the devil. So he's not loyal with his own children, because that would be against his nature, wouldn't it? A loyal devil. That would kind of be an oxymoron. So they don't have any friends. They don't help their buddies. If one is in need, well, it's your problem. You know, I'm going to step on your head to get out of a sinking boat. That's their mentality.
Yes,
I mean, this is one of the things that Fulbright has said. They're not above, you know, sacrificing their own people to prove a point or to do something.
Well, remember, they also believe in ceremonial energetic energies to protect them. They've got black magicians, you know. I mean, this is all, whether it's real or not real, they believe it. And that goes back to Hitler's time. So it's much more, from an energy standpoint, you know, it's much easier to build an energy grid around yourself if you're in a limited area than to, oh, I got to put one over here, and I got to put one over here, and I got to put one over here. So I think that that's one of the reasons that they come together, is strictly to maintain energy bases.
Well, and then, and the other thing is that that's the one thing that Wilcock reported that one time, where there were these strange tremors all over the country, and they kept reporting that deep underground bunkers were being destroyed. That was step number one, you know, destroy their retreat pathways. Because if those deep underground bunkers were still up and running, we'd all be dead by now, because they just hide underground and burn the surface so they can get on with their happy lives and then come up when life catches on again. So that was step one, you know, eliminate all those things so there's nowhere to run. Otherwise, they would already be, you know, in underground. And according to that that video that you have already seen, there's a deep underground bunker under the Getty Center. So who knows? There might be huge thousands, you know, in hiding underground.
Well, they burnt that thing the last year in 17.
Well, they burnt the surface. I don't know how deep those machines go.
Going down there, remember? I mean, who knows what they're really capable of? They took down the towers.
Yeah, well, that's sitting on the surface of the earth. What happens when you're thousands of feet underground? I don't know. I'm not a weapons expert, and I don't want to be either.
I hear you there. It's well, from a more 3D standpoint, the most fascinating thing I've seen this week was an article about a Army Reserve military police unit of 100 people.
Oh, yeah, I saw the photo on Facebook.
Yeah, that is very meaningful, because they were going to go to Guantanamo, and they were due to be there for like 100 days. That's a long, long stint for Army Reserves. Remember, an Army Reserve person is somebody who has a part-time job in the Army. So by taking these people out, you're jeopardizing their jobs.
Full-time jobs.
You know, and I was in the reserves for over 8 years, and I never ever heard of that happening unless it was a wartime footing. The company that I had been with went to Grenada. But again, I don't think that it was 100 days. You know, think about that. That's a third
over
of
3 months.
Yeah, it's over 3 months. I think it was 100 days. Seemed like it was longer than that. But regardless, if they're doing that to Guantanamo, that means Guantanamo is about to go very, very active. 100 military police, that's a lot of police in that facility. Very fascinating. And then there was this guy, he was a reporter, I forget his name, and the people that are investigating the Russian thing wanted him to lie, and he refused. And so he turned around, and he's got a suit against the, what's his face, the guy that's the head of the Oh, I should look at chat. Dolly probably knows. The guy that's the head of the Mueller. I think it was him. It was one of those guys that got, you know, is getting sued by this guy. And then another man said, no, I'm not going to lie. So people who are not, they're not, the threats are not working anymore in a very basic way. You know, I'm telling you, I think the veils are crumbling. It's the Wizard of Oz. Somebody has pulled back the curtain.
That's the thing is that before, you know, they threaten somebody and everything is so secretive. And if they threaten you, there's no place you can go because nobody will believe you what you're going to say. But now that the conspiracy is mutating, every day that passes, the word conspiracy is beginning to mean truth, real things.
Yeah,
it's
not
conspiracy anymore when you see evidence facing you. I mean, you can say if you're since the day you were born, people talk about horses and you've never seen one face to face, and it's just a fanciful notion that somebody invented. Fine, it's a conspiracy. There's no such thing as a horse. But then one day you go to the country and you get off the car and you're looking one in the face. Okay, people, it's not a conspiracy anymore. There actually are horses. So now, more every day that passes, you know, people are not shaking their heads at the notion of conspiracy because now, you know, somebody has a conspiracy about this. Well, guess what? They're writing about it. They're publishing articles about it. You know, this person's talking and that person's talking. Well, it's not a conspiracy anymore. It's actually happening, folks.
Well, it goes back to the Snowden release of the documents and the NSA. We were saying, you know, everything you do on the internet is in your computers is being, you know, monitored. Oh, you crazy conspiracy people. So he comes out, here's the document stating just that, and they go, "Oh, everybody knows that." It's like,
oh.
You know, it's like, no, you guys were calling it a conspiracy. You know, well, 10 years after, so in 11, in the 11 time frame, 2011 time frame, and you're trying to explain somebody to explain to them that 9/11 didn't happen the way they said it, most people would get very angry or walk away from you. Now people go, oh, everybody knows that. Not everybody, but a good portion of people out there now are willing to understand that. When the Fed asked, they were too big to fail, and we bailed them out, and nobody knew what the hell the Fed was, including myself. I really never looked at the entire structure of it. And you look at it now, and you know how basically evil and how it's not a bank. It doesn't operate like the concept of, you know, I'm going to loan you money, you give me back a little bit. You know, no, they make up money. They just, you know. What he said about how much trillion or what quadrillions, is that what he said? Is owed versus what is available. You know, that's making up money. I mean, the Federal Reserve, the bank system is not banking. It's a church. The only way it works is by the faith of the people in it. And more people don't believe in it anymore. And I think that you know, it's like you say, the old matrix thing is crumbling. And I think it's crumbling because we're looking at it with a slightly different perception. It's almost like, I'll give you an example. So I got this screen room back there, and I decide that I'm going to put windows in there, and I'm going to build up, make it solid. So, and this was, you know, 35 years ago or something, and I did a lot of this stuff by myself. And so, no problem, I'm going to do it, right? And I get the windows in and everything. And two of my friends, they're standing there. And something is odd. I can feel it. They're not saying anything, but something's very odd. And I go, is there a problem here? And they looked at each other, and then they looked at me, and they said, why is it so crooked? And I said, what do you mean it's crooked? And from their perspective, I must have been on some kind of a drug. This wall was so unbelievably not straight. And I hadn't seen it because I was looking at it at a different perspective. But because they could see it from... And that's what's happening. It's almost like our perspective on reality is seeing, my God, that's really crooked. This doesn't make any, this isn't going to stand. You know, it's a foundation that's based on crookedness. But I do think...
Yeah, well, and people are questioning more. They're not just being fed, you know, spoon-fed. You know, little by little, they're getting into the habit of... They're told, oh, this is supposed to be this way because blah, blah, blah. Why? Why is it supposed to be that way? Who says it's supposed to be that way? Just because it's been that way for 100 years doesn't mean that it has to continue being that way for the next million years. And people are questioning more and more the why of things. And that means that it's not happening all at once in one fell swoop, but it's happening drop by drop, person by person, people subtracting their consciousness, their unconditional belief in the system from the system. So imagine unplugging. You imagine all these, like in the Matrix, thousands of wires draining energy from all these humans and these bathtubs. Now they start pulling the wires. And people are pulling their wires. They're pulling their wires from the system. I don't believe in this anymore. I don't believe in this anymore. I'm questioning this. I doubt this. So what does that mean? All this flow of energy supporting this is going down, down, down. People are subtracting their consciousness from the collective belief that things should be this way. No, everybody's questioning. So that needle marking the amount of fuel in the tank, it's going down. And nobody's rushing to refill it.
And the gas stations are empty.
Yeah.
Because everybody's out using shungite devices developed by Walt Silva to power everything.
That'd be nice, right?
Oh, I got to tell you, when I'm writing the book, right, and I needed so much science from you, and then they lead me to these two original 4 hours altogether, where you delivered science that, yes, it's the foundation for what went on afterwards. But, Walt, some of the things that we discussed, I've never actually pursued with you or even in my own head. When I get this book done, you're going to have to go back and we're going to have another conversation about what have you done with this knowledge, if anything, and what can we do with this knowledge? Because again, if we're in an environment where it's like people are questioning reality, which means we've got an opportunity to create a reality that we want. Because rule one is, reality is what you think it is. Rule two is the majority rules, but that's energy. It's not necessarily numbers. So if we can agree and focus on a given reality, then that's what's going to manifest. And what I love about our shungite story is that, let's face it, in the beginning, I was the only person out there talking about it. Then I talked to JP. JP talks to you. You get interested. You make some kind of a device. Then you say something on Facebook. I'm going like, who the hell is this guy? And then I contact you. We have a marvelous number of conversations, and we arrange to go live on radio. We do two of the most incredible scientifically based shows I've ever done. The science that's in them is outstanding. And I think because nobody was paying attention to this amazing story, we began to dictate what the story would be. Because as soon as you start playing with it, we know, we influence, it's the energy thing, it's all energy. Shungite just intensifies our ability to interject our own concept, what might be or might, could
well,
be.
Well, one of the things you have to put there in the list, and here, Dali is a vital part of that, is, I don't know if that's what it is, maybe something different, but haven't we indirectly brought about Shungite AI? Because how else do we explain Dali being able to talk to these shungite-driven devices?
Yes, sir. I totally agree. Listen, we've blown through the 2 hours. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I thank the audience.
Everybody, have a great night.
Yes, and we'll talk. Well, tomorrow we've got Dolly Reedsview. I hope she's going to be live, but she's got a great Dolly Shares, and I'm pretty sure that Jody's going to get us. Why do you call it Jody? Jamie Bates will be getting us her recording. So tomorrow is another good day. Walt, I'll talk to you later. Be safe. Give a hug to Mom. And everybody out there, be safe, be blessed. Would you like to say good night, Walt?
Good night, everybody, and thank you for being with us. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Cosmic Reality Radio Show, produced by Haggy Shack Radio and simulcast over Cosmic Reality Radio. You are listening.